I'd like to call the House Special Committee to order at approximately 10:25. Today is February 16th, 2010. Present are Representative Munoz, Representative Millet, Vice Chair Keller, myself, Chair Edgman. As always, we'd like to remind everyone about their cell phones and to put them on silent if they would, please. Today, we plan on hearing two pieces of legislation. First, to hear House Joint Resolution 43, which pertains to federal funding for domestic seafood marketing. And afterwards, we will take testimony from the department on House Bill 266. And time permitting, we will take a public testimony. We do have a number of people who are interested in testifying on House Bill 266. And with that, committee members, unless there's any comments or questions before we get started, we'll just jump in and I'll call my staff, Tim Clark, to the table to present House Joint Resolution 43. Morning, Tim.
Good morning. My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman. This resolution communicates to the Obama administration, the Alaska congressional delegation, and hopefully Congress at large, the Alaska legislature's support for using a portion of federal revenues generated from duties on imported seafood and fish products for the marketing of American seafood domestically, including seafood harvested in the state of Alaska. Since the 1990s, well over 50% of the fish consumed annually by American families is the product of foreign countries. And every year, the governments of many of these countries bankroll multi-million dollar campaigns to market their seafood to Americans. While the state of Alaska provides significant contributions toward marketing of Alaska seafood, and the Alaska seafood industry itself self-assesses for significant funding for seafood marketing, those amounts in the end aren't adequate to fund the vigorous, consistent, and innovative promotion that our products require in the face of foreign competition. Meanwhile, every year, hundreds of millions of dollars are derived from duties on these imported fish and fish products that so aggressively compete with American seafood. Yet only an insignificant fraction of this revenue has ever been employed to promote domestically produced seafood. The resolution endorses putting a portion of these revenues to work in developing and maintaining the robust domestic markets that healthy, sustainable Alaskan seafood deserves. The resolution urges Congress to pass legislation dedicating such funding for the effective domestic marketing of American seafood, and it asks the Alaska delegation in Congress to work together with representatives from other seafood producing states to accomplish these goals.
Thank you, Tim. Are there any questions for Mr. Clark? Not seeing any, we'll call next to the table. We'll, on behalf of UFA's National Seafood Marketing Coalition, I'd like to bring Julie Decker and Bruce Wallace, if you would, to come up to the table and identify yourself for the record and your affiliation, and we'd like to hear your comments on HJR 43.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Julie Decker. I'm representing UFA's, United Fishermen of Alaska's National Seafood Marketing Coalition. This is Bruce Wallace. We're part of a four-member team working to build this coalition. United Fishermen of Alaska has taken the initiative to create this coalition, National Seafood Marketing Coalition. One of the reasons that Alaska is positioned to take a leadership role here is because we are a world leader in seafood production, management, and marketing. Tim has given a good overall description of the bill, so I will keep my comments brief. United Fishermen of Alaska and ASME have both passed either a letter of support or resolution of support for this concept and for building the coalition. Basically, the concept behind this is that we would like to take import duties that currently come to the United States on fish and fish products and invest them on domestic marketing of seafood. And through that investment, projects like not only advertising, but product development, quality improvements, infrastructure improvements, those kinds of things will happen on a national basis throughout the country based on regional boards that will decide how the regions should best use those monies. And the result of that will be improved competitiveness of U.S. seafood, increased value of the product, increased product forms, economic growth in the nation, including job creation, which is desperately needed at this time, and also better overall health, as we all know seafood is healthy for our country. So we've already started building this coalition. We've taken one trip to the East Coast, and we will be going around the country for the rest of the spring. Eventually, we will build this tight coalition. We'll have a face-to-face meeting. Everyone will be on the same board. And the idea then will be the coalition will take it forward to Congress to get some legislation passed to actually set these funds aside every year, annually. So this resolution is fairly simple, and we're just asking for your support for this concept in general and for the coalition. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Ms. Decker, any questions for Julie? Not seeing any. Mr. Wallace, did you want to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments. I think it's been fairly well covered. Alaska, one of the things that I am involved in is I am on the ASME board. And as I have been able to go to the Boston show and even the global economy, which has had members of your body go to the Brussels show particularly, it's pretty clear that Alaska has developed and extended a kind of a working relationship that has both government and private enterprise, ASME being, you know, sort of a prime example. And it's worked. It's been very successful for Alaska. We believe that the model would work in a national structure. It's sort of lead a horse to water, I guess. And that's the intent of this, is to get to that point where we have this aggregation of marine states, both legislative and industrial components therein, in one place to talk about it. What we get out of that will be decided there, but this is a step process, and it's imperative, I think, that the people around the United States see the state of Alaska's government as being hand in hand with the Alaska industry on this issue, because that's the way the model would work in its final form. Regardless of the particulars of it, it has to be a joint working relationship, and Alaska's got that history, and we can show that. So you get to be sort of the first in the bucket, as it were. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Representative Munoz?
Thank you. Are there other boards similar to ASME in the U.S.?
There are six states currently building legislation. The main legislation actually cites ASME as the model. But to our knowledge, there are a couple in the South that have sort of a, like the Shrimp Alliance has a component that kind of operates, but is not formally structured and doesn't have the same funding. The idea of taxing themselves is a novel idea, apparently. So the answer is, while they're looking at it right now, currently, no. But I think it is a thing that will, within 2 years, if you ask me that question, would probably have an answer of at least six and maybe more than that.
Additional questions?
That's fine.
Okay. Any other questions? Bruce, I've got a question that actually was Julie who mentioned a moment ago, probably the one of you, about regional organizations. And what are we, Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on that and then give us some kind of a ballpark sort of estimation of what kind of money we're talking about here if this ever were to be in place?
Sure. Well, at this time, like Bruce mentioned, we have a concept that we're sort of putting forward as the initiators of this project. Our concept at this time is to create 9 regional boards around the country. The 8 would sort of follow the structure of the management councils, the regional management councils, and then the 9th would be representative of sort of inland production. And the second question was funding. What we're targeting is approximately $100 million, and we're suggesting half of that should come from the USDA money that comes from the import duties on fish and fish products, and then the other 50% from anti-dumping countervailing duties. And so we feel like there's congressional intent that we can cite that those monies, you know, in that size should be used for the promotion and development of fisheries.
What kind of reception did you get back east on here?
It was very good, actually. You know, many different regions, they all have their issues, their problems. And a lot of other areas are doing worse than Alaska. And so, you know, people were sort of happy to see that there is a potential of something, a bright star on the horizon. So, you know, everyone has a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about, and it takes a little bit of an education process to get across, you know, our idea so it matches with their idea. But in general, people are very excited about it.
Okay, good. Any additional questions?
Just one thing about the regional aspect. The idea, this is federally funded money, so you have the largest theater to operate in. But the idea is to bring it back to the regions and let the regions, through an agreed process of how that money would be shared out before it was ever shared, would actually allow them the opportunity to evolve their own solutions. Because it's not intended to be a dictating type of thing, and it's not intended to be a situation where, you know, there would be a general rule, for instance, that would have to be applied to everybody and then trying to make it fit. So the ideas are still fluid in that sense, but the structure is fairly obvious. And the phone calls that I've had around the United States, everybody seems to agree, you know, the devil is in the detail always, but everybody agrees with the general structure that I've talked to, and that's about 25 calls to, well, just about every region of the United States at this point.
Okay. Well, great. Not seeing any additional questions. Thank you both for coming forward. Is there anyone else that we've lined up to address this resolution, Tim? I don't think so. So we will next go into public testimony. Is there anyone online who wishes to testify on HGR 43? Not hearing as such. Is there anyone here in the committee room who wishes to offer comments on HGR 43? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close testimony. We will turn next to committee deliberation. Are there any comments or questions, committee members? HGR 43, Representative Millett.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, I signed on as a co-sponsor.
Okay, thank you for doing that. What is the will of the committee then with HR 43?
Are you ready to move?
Yeah. I am.
Okay, I'd like to move House Joint Resolution 43, version R, with accompanying individual reports, and ask for unanimous consent.
Is there any objection to the motion on the table? Not hearing any. So moved, and we will take a 1 minute break to transact the document that we all need to sign, and we will come online in a few moments and begin a hearing from the Department of House Bill 266.
Kathy.
Yeah.
Record. And next we will turn our attention to House Bill 266, and what I'd like to do is based on the number of questions that remained from our hearing last week on House Bill 266 is to have representatives from the Department of Fish and Game come forward if they would please and discuss sonar equipment and how that's employed with other management tools is relating to this issue. And time permitting, and I think that we will probably have time, we will then go into public testimony. For members' edification, be advised that the bill sponsor has informed us that he plans to come forward with the committee substitute on the bill. Obviously, we don't have it before us today, so we'll be discussing the bill that we do have before us today, which we heard initially last week. And we also have Lance Nelson with the Department of Law online, I believe, if there's any questions that need to be directed towards Mr. Nelson. And with that, Mr. Hilsinger and Ms. Juhas, if you would identify yourself for the record, please, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jennifer Juhas. I'm the legislative liaison for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We testified at the last committee hearing that the department does not take a position on allocative issues, but there were several questions regarding sonar, how we make our decisions for management of our fisheries. And there's some confusion over what is the difference between a sonar projection and the complexities associated with that. You know, sonar, for the record, is one decision point in an entire decision-making matrix. It is not the sole method by which we make our in-season management decisions. So we've brought John Hilsinger, our Director of Commercial Fisheries, to explain that.
Morning, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Hilsinger, Director of Commercial Fisheries. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would maybe just preface those questions with a little explanation about sonar. Sonar is really the last resort for counting fish. We use sonar only in what are really the most challenging situations. If you have a clear river where you can see the fish, we don't use sonar. If you have a small enough river that you could put a weir across it, we wouldn't use a sonar. What's really left for sonar are the big rivers, the turbid or glacial rivers where you can't see the fish, the very long rivers like the Yukon that are also turbid and wide. And so that's really a tool that we use only in the most challenging of situations. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if you'd like maybe some examples of how we use that or the history of it, I'd be happy to do that as well.
Questions, Committee Member Sharps and Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, as long as we have your expertise here, would you give us, from your view, the outline of the priorities that are in place now as to the fisheries, starting with subsistence fisheries, please?
Through the chair, Representative Book, in state law, clearly the subsistence fishery has the priority, and there's actually quite a complex system for determining, you know, how big of a run we would have before we could allow the other types of fisheries to occur. The other fisheries all are basically right now equal in priority in state law. The Board of Fisheries does often, through its management plans, it can set area priorities. For instance, you might see in the late-run Kenai sockeye plan that they're managed primarily for commercial uses, or you know, in the early part of Cook Inlet, it manages some of those stocks primarily for recreational purposes. So there are times when the Board of Fisheries actually within an area sets priorities. But as far as the state as a whole goes, all the other fisheries except subsistence are equal priority.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions, Vice Chair Keller?
if you would, I know a limited amount about sonar, a little bit of reading I've done. It looks like I think our system was largely developed up here. I mean, the technology is improving, I understand, and all that. I'd like to just a little bit of an update on where we've come from, where we're going, you know, on the sonar technology.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Keller, you're correct. The original fish counting sonars were developed by the Bendix Corporation, working with our staff largely on the Kenai River. A fellow named Al Menon, who's kind of a legend in Alaskan fisheries, developed those and built them for Bendix Corporation. So that technology really is what was available back in the late 60s and early 70s. I think the last ones that we bought probably were in the early 80s when we actually purchased those. So they do have some limitations. One of the big limitations was that there's no way to get a data file out that you can save. All the calculations are done within the sonar box, and it just prints out a number. And there's limitations on the range and some other things. So as time went by, we wanted to have better counters. We found that there were a lot of situations where the Bendix counters were too limited. They only will count out to about 60 feet from shore. And so they worked very well for sockeye and in some systems for chum salmon, which are bank-oriented. But when you get into some of these bigger river systems and you get into species like Chinook salmon that are stronger, can swim further offshore, we needed a different kind of counter. And so we went to a series of different types. Some were made by the Biosonics Corporation or HTI, and another corporation. And these are counters that can shoot out, excuse me, maybe 250 yards as opposed to about 20 yards. And those work very well in a lot of situations. Places like the Yukon River, we tend to use those more because the fish can be distributed so far offshore. The last iteration of counters is the one that you hear about a lot now, the DIDSON counter, which stands for Dual Frequency Identification Sonar. And they actually were designed at the Applied Physics Laboratory in Seattle at the University of Washington for the Navy to be able to find things like sunken submarines and that kind of stuff. And they've proven to be extremely useful in a lot of the situations where we used to use the Bendix counters. So you're seeing them replace the Bendix counters in the Kenai River, the Yentna River. We've got them now in the Copper River. One of the great advantages of the DIDSON counter is that because the image that comes back comes from 96 different beams, each one of those beams actually can hit that fish. And so when you look at the computer screen that's hooked up to the counter, you actually can see the fish. You can see it swim. You see its tail. You see the fins flip. You can tell a little bit on size. You can tell a Dolly Varden, for instance, from a salmon. You can't tell a pink salmon from a sockeye salmon. But you can tell some of the smaller fish. The other advantage to them is that they can be used in certain bottom profiles where the others cannot be used. Normally you can't shoot a sonar into the bottom because you get the bounce back of the beam, and that blots out your ability to see anything. But with the DIDSONs, you can actually shoot them right at the bottom and still get a picture of the fish back. So we use them in places where we have a concave bottom where you can't shoot a straight beam because the fish would be underneath it. And so it really has given us a lot more flexibility in some areas. And some of our projects now, we use a split beam sonar on one side and a DIDSON on the other, to just because that fits the two bottom contours the best. You know, I don't know what the next generation will be, but we have actually found that, you know, we have substantially better ability to count now. The problem really still that we face is that the species apportionment. So the sonar basically counts fish, and we have to figure out whether those are king salmon or sockeye or chum or pinks or in some river systems like on the Yukon, at our lower Yukon sonar, we get a lot of whitefish. We get, you know, tens of thousands of whitefish. So we have to do a program of actually catching fish to see what the mix of species is. And that's called the species apportionment. And that's really the big challenge now in a lot of cases. On the Yukon River, you may have a run of 2 million to 4 million summer chum salmon, and mixed in amongst those is 150,000 king salmon. So somehow out of those 4 million sonar counts, you have to figure out the correct proportions before you can accurately estimate the number of king salmon. And it's the same thing on the Yentna River. There you have a lot of pink salmon in some years. And so this year, I think it looked like we probably had about 650,000 pink salmon and maybe 150,000 sockeye. So that getting those proportions correct to have an accurate estimate is the big challenge. Thank you.
Can I get a follow-up?
Follow-up, Captain Keller.
whatever the limitations are, I get the impression that Alaska kind of leads the globe in this thing, and that we're doing a pretty good job with our sonar counting, at least compared to the rest of the world. Is that accurate? My understanding is pretty limited, and I was just wondering.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think that's accurate. I think that we've got it's a large and really well-developed program. We've got really well-trained people. We've been pretty successful in some really challenging situations. I think, you know, there was a lot of in the news about the Yukon sonar this summer, and, you know, one of the reporters, I think, reported that it, quote, was broken or didn't work. And yet, actually, when you look at the challenges that we faced, we had floods, we had high debris, we had silt because of the flood that actually blocked the sonar beam. There was so much silt in the water. And yet, we still probably had an estimate of that king salmon run that was within 20% of the true value. And so I think that when you can estimate something like that within plus or minus 20%, I think that's very good.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions?
It's an additional one, if that's all right.
Please.
I'd like to back up, actually, to something you said to Representative Book. I just want to make sure I understood. You said right now you manage for specific reasons, like some of your late runs for commercial, and then I think you made a statement that there were some that you managed for sports fish. And I just, what are some examples? I just try and understand, you know.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, if you look at the management plans in Upper Cook Inlet, for example, you'll see that the salmon stocks that run in Upper Cook Inlet before the 1st of July are primarily managed for recreational purposes. You see very little in the way of commercial fisheries during that early season, and to the extent that there are commercial fisheries, they're either limited or they're late in that time period. So the opening dates of the fisheries or the amount of fishing time that's allowed is limited in order to provide. So like the early Russian River sockeye is one of those runs that comes through and is primarily for recreational purposes. The later coho runs that come through in August are managed primarily for recreational purposes. You'll see closures in the commercial fishery around the 10th of August. So those later running fish are not harvested in the commercial fishery and come through to the recreational fishery.
Just a quick follow-up. It isn't that you're necessarily managing for the fishery, it just kind of would make sense too, right? I mean, your escapement, therefore, maybe it makes more sense to limit the commercial at certain times of the run, you know, to for counting, and that it isn't necessarily for the benefit of the industry, but that's the way it kind of works out. I mean, there's at least some of that, right?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, a lot of those things were worked out in the late 70s when the first Upper Cook Inlet Management Plan was written. And I think actually at that time they did consider how to kind of divide up the run between the recreational and commercial fisheries in a way that sort of fit the situation at the time. There may be some situations where, because we don't have real good stock assessment later, you know, that the commercial fishery would be limited anyway because of uncertainty in the stock assessment, those kinds of things. But and so then by default, maybe a lot of the run would go to the recreational user. I think an example of that might be the coho salmon on the Yukon River. There's very limited commercial fisheries. There's limited stock assessment late in the run. We get huge coho runs into the Delta Clearwater that support a sport fishery, and that was not a conscious decision on the part of the board. It's just kind of how the fact that it's late in the season, there's not a lot of stock assessment information, it's hard to have much of a commercial fishery, so it's more of a de facto allocation than an actual conscious allocation.
Thank you so much.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. I just have a question about the maturity of each fishery. So I would assume that the Upper Cook Inlet and where Representative Keller is from, is that a pretty mature, do you have a lot of data on that? Do you understand that fishery as well as, like, you may understand Cordova or Bristol Bay? Or, I mean, is there some historical data that goes back? Because what I wonder is how much the commercial fisheries, because it seems that commercial fisheries have been in place for a while, but the increase in personal use and recreational users has, by population, you can assume that has doubled over the last 20 years, that has become a popular recreation for not just folks that live in Matsu, but also folks that live in my district in Anchorage. And so is it a mature enough fishery where you can adjust the management for the additional personal use and the recreational and balance that with we're always going to have allocation arguments, but is it a mature enough fishery where you can balance that allocation between commercial and the sports and personal use fishers?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, probably the thing that varies the most in that regard with respect to the different fisheries is the complexity of the fishery more than the amount of time or data. You have actually probably the fishery with the most data is probably Bristol Bay. Mm-hmm. They have spawner recruit what we call brood tables that go clear back into the 50s, way beyond any fishery anywhere in Alaska. We have quite a bit of data on Upper Cook Inlet. Commercial catches go back into the 1800s, and we have a pretty active stock identification program, pretty good escapement estimation on a lot of the major runs, not all of them, and I think probably in Upper Cook Inlet, the Susitna drainage and the rest of the northern district, I would characterize as probably having the poorest history of data, and obviously we've found in recent years that using the Bendix sonars in the Yentna River was substantially undercounting the number of fish that were actually in the river. So we're actually learning a lot about the Susitna drainage just in the last few years because the legislature did make some money available to do those studies, and I think it's paid off a lot. Do we have the tools to manage changes in allocation? I think that we do if the board were to put specific allocations in place. We have some tools. It's very difficult there because you have a mixed stock, mixed species fishery, and when you open those fisheries, they're harvesting stocks bound for a large number of streams. And so I guess I would characterize it that you don't have a scalpel. You have more of a kind of a meat cleaver or a hatchet in order to adjust those fisheries. So in terms of an area like the Susitna, you'll probably always see a little more variability in our ability to hit specific management targets just because of the the nature of the runs. That doesn't mean we don't try. We do, we take that very seriously, the idea of making the escapement goals in the Susitna drainage. We do try to do that. It's just very difficult. And so, as I've sort of characterized it, you know, if you were on a basketball field and you had 2 seconds left on the clock and you threw the ball to the basket, you'd either make it or you wouldn't. And you might say afterwards, if I'd have thrown it a little harder or a little to the left, I could have made it. But that's probably one of the most challenging fishery management decisions that we have in the state. I would put it up there with the Yukon River for being a difficult challenge and a difficult goal to make.
And then on the personal use side, how are we doing on getting data back from folks that use the personal use fisheries, the dip netting fisheries? Are we getting good, solid data back from those fishers on what their catch actually is? I mean, how are we obtaining that data? Is it something that's mandated when you get a dip net permit, you have to come back, and are we doing that?
Representative Millett, yes. In the Cook Inlet personal use fisheries, there is a permit. People write on the permit what their harvest is. They have to turn it in. I think this year we issued something like 29,000 permits. And I think that it's probably a pretty good estimate of the catch. We do hear complaints about people not following the catch limits and that sort of thing. But compared to a lot of personal use fisheries where we don't have a specific reporting requirement, I think the staff is pretty diligent, and the people seem to be very good about getting the permits and filling them out. A lot of the issues have to do with people not filling the permit out right as they leave the water. Maybe they fill it out a little bit later, and so if somebody stops them on the boat launch ramp, they would not have had it filled out yet. And as with most fisheries, I think, a lot of the public would like to see more enforcement effort put into that. But actually, I know, and that fishery actually is handled by Sport Fish Division, but they've even had a lot of the Sport Fish staff go down to some of the boat launch ramps and check people and try to contribute to that effort to enforce that fishery. But that enforcement is an issue in that fishery that you hear a lot from the public.
I know the King tag, the use on King tags has worked out. I mean, I think you have real accurate data on King tags, especially in South Central. I mean, you get a King tag, you write it down the second you get the fish, and guided fishing is even more restrictive. I mean, the guides really, really, and I just wonder about our reporting requirements on our personal use and dip net fisheries, if we have accurate data on what the catch actually is.
I think, Representative Millett, that I would characterize that as good data. Is it, I don't know if there's ways, I don't know if the Sport Fish Division staff have thought about ways they could make it better, but mm-hmm. but I think they have a pretty high return rate. So I would say that it seems to be pretty good.
So just as a follow-up, so the department has pretty good numbers in terms of what how many people are dip netting and any trend analysis they've been able to develop along those lines?
Mr. Chairman, the numbers appear to be increasing, and this 2009, I think, was the highest. I think the previously it was kind of in the range of 23,000 to 25,000 permits, and this year I think that it went up to about 29,000. The harvest is increasing. I think people are learning the fishery. They're learning to be more effective. You see increasing use of boats in that fishery, which makes people more effective. They actually can drift at the mouth of the river with their net and be fairly effective. So my impression is that there is a notable growth in that fishery.
And are most of those Alaskan residents, presumably?
Mr. Chairman, presumably they're required to have a resident sport fishing license in order to participate.
Okay. Before we go to Representative Kawasaki, the record needs to reflect that both Representative Kawasaki and Representative Book have been here for some time, and with my apologies, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard you mention the sonar station at the Yukon, and that it was fairly close, and I think you said 20% within the 20% limit. Is that typical for sonar to be within that range? It seems like a huge amount of error, potentially.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, that actually, in terms of estimating numbers of fish, plus or minus 20% is pretty good. When we do our tower counts in Bristol Bay, which arguably might be considered about one of the best, we actually have a sampling scheme that we think puts us within plus or minus 10%. So given the challenges that we face this year with the high water and debris and the silt, I think 20% is pretty good. People on the Yukon River and, of course, in fisheries throughout the state are demanding more and more precise management every year. You see more complexity in the management plans, more precise management triggers. You see the demand for the genetic stock identification so we can kind of fine-tune these things more and more. And so we recognize that we need to try to do a better job of estimating those numbers, and we actually have some ideas for pilot station for this coming summer to try to improve that count. We're going to look for another site to see if we can find a better bottom profile. We are going to employ what's called a side scan sonar, which actually looks down. I'm not sure why they call it a side scan, but it looks down and out, and you deploy it from a boat. And the idea there is that we'll be able to run that out offshore and see if there is that silt layer that's blocking the shore-based sonar, if we can detect then if fish are moving outside that silt layer. And we'll be looking both for better locations near the present site as well as the potential of a better site downstream. There's probably better sites upstream. I think we would be more successful going upstream, but the problem there is the further upstream you are, the longer your count is delayed from the fishery. So the primary fishery occurs down there at the mouth that harvests the largest numbers. And so if you move another 100 miles upriver, then you're 6 days late instead of 3 days late. Right now, the lag time from the mouth to the sonar is about 3 days. So that's a fair amount of time to, by the time the fish pass the sonar, they're already through the entire District 1. And so it makes a challenge to try to sort of project the fish coming into the river, what's going to go past the sonar in 3 days, have whatever fisheries you can have, and then still meet your sonar goals. The other sonar at Eagle is a much, much simpler location. You've basically got one species. At Pilot Station, as I mentioned, you've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of chum salmon mixed with the kings. You've got hundreds of thousands of whitefish, shefish, pike. And so that's a challenge there. And you don't have those problems at Eagle, so it's a lot easier, probably a lot more accurate count. But you still run into this situation where you've got a sonar estimate with a confidence interval, and then you've got a sonar estimate with a confidence interval at Eagle, and you're subtracting those. That's kind of your report card. And depending on how those confidence intervals work, you may think that you put, 12,000 extra fish across the border into Canada, but you may not have. That may just be that one was at the high end of its confidence interval and one was at the low end. So there's a lot of uncertainty there that we're trying to deal with.
Follow-up, President Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can appreciate the complexity. It's obviously not an exact science, and, you really can't tell what goes through those weirs. But 20% seems like a high number. I think close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. 20% seems for a million run fishery is 200 salmon or 200,000 salmon, which I know there were a lot of folks. I was listening to the Yukon River Drainage Association folks mm-hmm. in their regular teleconference meeting, and they'd call in and tell us how the fishery was doing, what the fish looked like. It was really kind of an interesting thing with Senator Kukesh, because of course they had difficulties this year, and and then to find out at the end that maybe part of it had to do with a sonar problem, I think was disconcerting. You mentioned later on that you think that you do have the tools to sort of work through the crux of this bill on allocative issues. You said it's more of a cleaver than a scalpel style. I kind of want to challenge that. I think it's a much, much tougher issue. Can you tell us just with this bill how you would do that, I guess? how the department would approach this bill?
Representative Kawasaki, probably in a lot of these fisheries that are very complex and have very contentious allocation issues, it likely would, at least in part, go to the Board of Fisheries to develop some of the methodology for implementing this through the management plans and the various triggers that they would set. And so in a fishery like Upper Cook Inlet, I think you would see some elements incorporated into the management plan. In other places, for instance, there's personal use fisheries around Fairbanks in the non-subsistence area there, and I don't think that you would, need to see a particular management plan to deal with the issues there. But in some of the more contentious areas and with larger personal use fisheries and larger commercial fisheries, you may. And you actually see that now. You see, for instance, on the Copper River, there's actually some triggers built into the regulations about if such and such happens in the personal use fishery, then, what happens in the commercial fishery. And if something happens in the commercial fishery, certain things happen in the personal use fishery. So I think you would see those kinds of regulations developed by the boards to try to implement some of the details of this.
I'd like also, before we go to Representative Book, to acknowledge that Representative Kelly's been sitting in the audience for almost a half an hour, and Mike, you're more than welcome to join us at the table if you desire to come up and spend some more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Here. Next, we will go to Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a personal experience and something that I used to do on a regular basis, going down from Anchorage to fish the Russian River, there was I was amazed after a period of years at the almost scientific exactness with which the department would be able to predict and have openers on not only the sanctuary there but the Russian River. And for those of us that fish that recreationally, it was a fisheries that was very, very specific. You had a sockeye run that hit the mouth. 3 days later, they were at the Russian River, and they hit the mouth about the 12th of June every year. So about the 15th, and somehow or other, the department would have it nailed, whether it was the 13th or the 16th or the 17th for the opener. And when you'd get there, the fish would be there. And then you'd go into the around the 4th of July, would when the commercial fishermen would really kick off, and the other sockeye would hit the Kenai River drainage in general. And so you'd have very, very specific fisheries. And in response to Representative Keller's question, that in some ways the department has done an exemplary job of being able to focus those. So one of them was managed as a recreational fisheries, one of them was managed as a commercial fisheries, and then the overlap where you had, you know, recreational fishermen trying to fish the Kenai fishermen at the same time you had the commercial fishermen trying to make a living down there. There was huge interest with the guides, the recreational fishermen, and then the subsequent king salmon fisheries down there, which has really been enhanced as far as an economic developer. So looking at what they have done in that particular fisheries alone, in my personal experience, it's been amazing at how they've been able to separate some of the uses and some of the specialty interests that have been out there, special interests, if you will. So in the Cook Inlet, it seems because we've had a history since the 50s. We knew at one time that the Russian River was one of the biggest sport fishing interests in the world for rainbow salmon. Well, the biggest interest now is silvers. Not silvers, but reds. And so people go up there to fish those. They fish for rainbows on the river. And it's a huge recreational interest there that starts in the middle of June and ends probably when the last of the sockeyes go through there at the end of July. In that regard, I have personal experience with that, but the commissioner or the deputy, what is your
director?
Director. In his knowledge and his expertise coming up through the ranks of, you know, being educated here and working here and having the influence of all of these other opportunities enveloped on him, the undertaking here is, you know, you have very specific interests that he's dealing with. And I really appreciate that. And I'm wondering how that all works together with some of the comments that we've had today is, how does this bill relate to what it is that you're trying to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boop, we do have a lot of different interests, and that's why in Upper Cook Inlet I think there's something like 18 different regulatory management plans that the managers have to follow. As you add complexity, you make it a little bit more difficult for the manager to meet all the targets. And so we do have pretty precise management on the Kenai. You've got a sonar there at mile 19 that is about a day and a half from the mouth of the river, and it does allow pretty precise management in some years. In some years it's very imprecise because of the other elements in the management plan. We had a period of time with, you know, we have the escapement goals, we had windows when we were not allowed to have fisheries, and then we have limits on the amount of extra commercial fishing time. And so with those constraints in place, it made it very difficult to meet our escapement goals. And we saw escapements of well over 1 million fish in the Kenai River. And part of what we're seeing now is the returns off those large escapements are not very big. That's why part of the reason that we're forecasting such poor returns, for instance, for this summer for the Kenai. And so it certainly is up to the public how they want to use those resources and how they want to set those priorities. And as Ms. Juha said, we're strictly neutral in that, but we have seen that in trying to accommodate all those different interests, it has made it far more difficult for the managers to hit their targets and to, you know, get the full commercial harvest and provide for the recreational users. So it does make management more complex, but, you know, that's what you pay us to do.
Representative Book?
I'm trying to see how we can make this work. The policy, is this more confusing for the department? Is this something that a bill like this is going to be able to accomplish? My question is, you know, your neutral position, as you stated it, doesn't give me confidence either way as to advocate or not, or oppose this bill. So if it makes it nearly impossible for you to do your job by complication, then I would have to oppose the bill. If it gives you opportunity to refine whatever and support some of the technology and investment that you have, then I would have to support the bill. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, trying to dig into that skull, sir, and figure out how we can work together on or against this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Response, Mr. Hilsinger?
Mr. Chair, this bill does not make it impossible for us to do our job in Cook Inlet. I think it will make it a little bit more difficult. It certainly does not make it impossible.
Before we go to Vice Chair Keller, I'd like to ask, can you put this in context in terms of other fisheries and personal use applications? Are we talking just exclusively at this point, South Central? Let's look ahead 5-10 years. Are there other areas that there may be other personal use fisheries? Are we just talking specifically dip netting at this point in all practical terms?
Mr. Chairman, there is a number of personal use fisheries throughout the state. Probably the largest ones are in South Central, the dip net fisheries, and there's also a gillnet fishery at the mouth of the Kasilof that occurs a little bit earlier. You have the dip net fishery on the Copper River, but there are personal use fisheries, for instance, king crab in southeast Alaska, many of the non-subsistence areas. There's personal use fisheries in around Fairbanks in the non-subsistence area. So this is a characteristic or an aspect of the fishery that is pretty widespread throughout the state, and so I think that as time goes by, you may see more issues develop related to personal use fishing.
So I guess to add to what Representative Book was saying then, according to this bill, and I realize that we're going to have a committee substitute coming for the committee here at some point in the near future, given the sort of uncertainties attached to achieving escapement goals, in many occasions using sonar equipment, there has to be some implication for the department, assuming that this bill were to pass, and the department having to restrict other fisheries, with the exception of subsistence, in terms of achieving escapement goals. So you've got to change the way you do things. And so there's got to be an additional role or some reconfiguring or some difference in approach by the department.
Mr. Chairman, in my understanding of this, it would sort of, within the non-subsistence areas, it would make, give personal use fishing kind of the type of priority that we currently give to subsistence. And we deal with that priority with subsistence. We specifically manage fisheries to provide a priority for subsistence. In that case, it does create some problems. We run into the problem in a place like the Yukon River where the run looks pretty good. We have a commercial harvest. Then we find out the latter part of the run is weak, and we need to close subsistence. later on. And so then we're in this situation where we've had a commercial fishery, harvested maybe a fair number of fish, and now we've got a subsistence closure. So, you know, did we really meet the priority? Did we provide a priority for subsistence? I can tell you that a lot of people upriver say no, you know, we made a huge mistake and that we should, you know, only allow the subsistence fishery until we're absolutely sure. You know, that makes it, under that scenario, it's almost impossible to then provide for the commercial fishery. And the commercial and subsistence fisheries are intertwined. In some cases, it's almost impossible for a person to be a subsistence fisherman without a commercial fishery to generate the cash to buy a boat and outboard nets and the fuel to go fishing. So it really is kind of a complex situation. And to some extent, I think you may end up with some of those same concerns on a maybe, you know, within the more complex fisheries like Upper Cook Inlet, if we, you know, start out the commercial fishery and then the run's weak and we have to restrict the personal use fishery, then we kind of run into that same question about have we really met the priority or not.
Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, this actually is a little bit more of a comment, but I'd like to do it while you're there. We have in our packets 30-40 letters from commercial fishermen adamantly opposing this bill. And it just occurred to me as I was reading through them today that I've gotten, you know, a significant number of people sending letters to me saying, you know, pass this. This is a really good deal. And that got me thinking that, you know, the personal use fishery doesn't have lobbyists. The personal use fishery doesn't have a tax, doesn't have a driver at all. And so, you know, I just, as someone who's been up here since 1963 and supplemented my family's diets for 40-some years with both sports and personal use fisheries, you know, I feel very personally engaged in this. And many of my friends, you know, of course, you know, in my community, we go dip netting or whatever, you know, on a regular basis. And it's a very significant part of what Alaska is. And even though it makes your life more complicated, I think it's a very important bill. And so, anyway, thanks for the comment. And also, it was a question maybe for you, and you know, it'll give you a chance to respond. But if the committee has not been getting those letters that I've been getting in support of this, do you want me to supply them, or have they? And they just didn't. Am I not seeing them? Or
I think we have been distributing those letters. We have been getting the last several days in my office a flood of commentary on this bill.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm looking at my committee aide, but I think we've been distributing those emails and any other correspondence. We've got some POMs as well to committee members.
I want to be quick to add, I mean, your committee aide and you do you're real fair, and that was not in any way an accusation. I just was just got to contemplating that, you know, the significance of those letters, you know, as we're sitting here.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks. I had a couple questions on how personal use fisheries is created, and I think that there was a little bit of statement that maybe there wasn't really sort of a design, not like the subsistence criteria where they have a set 8 criteria that they have to pass. So is it true that there's not, I mean, I don't know if you're the one to answer this or if there's law online or somebody else, but could you tell me the how a personal use fishery is created?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, yes, the board of fisheries created the personal use fisheries. This actually happened in the early 1980s, you know, particularly related to salmon. The runs came back very strong. You had harvestable surpluses. I can remember Governor Hammond talking about the idea of personal use fisheries, and in order to provide residents a little bit more efficient way of getting fish. And so the board actually created those fisheries. People put proposals in to create a personal use fishery or to expand it or whatever, and so then the board deliberates that, looks clearly at the allocation criteria that the legislature has adopted and given them to look at in these allocation issues, and then they make a decision about whether to adopt that fishery or not.
And it sounded like who was it that testified on how they design a personal use? Was that you?
Did
you?
I think we had the Department of Law talk about
the Department of Law
last week.
Okay, so I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. What if the board says, you know, I know what it was, that usually they design it based on the fishery, the specific location, or what's to prevent the board from saying all fisheries are personal use fisheries? Or, you know, is there anything that would prevent the board from doing that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, the board, there are some things. For instance, the personal use fishery requires a resident sport fishing license. So if you were to take all the sport fisheries in the state and say they're now personal use fisheries, you would eliminate all non-residents from being able to fish in those fisheries. I'm not sure what would happen. I guess if you turned the commercial fisheries into personal use fisheries, you would basically eliminate commercial fishing because you wouldn't be allowed to sell the fish. So there are some good reasons from a public policy perspective that the board would want to maintain the different categories in order to provide a variety of opportunities for the economy and well-being of the people.
I had more questions.
Actually,
this is more just a comment that I appreciate that the department and director believe that they can do this. And it might be more of a cleaver than a scalpel in sort of deciding the allocative issues. But, and I also appreciate that whenever the department comes before a committee that they're always very helpful in saying that they don't need an extra, a huge amount of money to do it, that they could do it internally. But if you do need the extra money, and if there is study that needs to happen, and if sonars just don't work, and there's a better technology out there, so that we're able to figure out a little bit more about our fishery, then I'd appreciate that information. And we can talk off record too. But I appreciate the work that you guys do. Again, it's not an exact science here, and there's all sorts of things going on. We wouldn't have this debate if it weren't for folks in Fairbanks that are complaining that they're about ready to hit me over the head for not supporting this bill right away, and then of course we've got a bunch of commercial fish folks here in the room, and a bunch of emails. I don't know. I want to hear more from the agency on how this bill will impact the state, and so I guess that's my comment. Thanks.
Well, Representative Kawasaki, obviously, we will have further discussion on this bill and a newer iteration that comes forward when it does by way of a committee substitute. So we will be asking the department and perhaps even the sports division to come forward and address that committee substitute as well. And I suspect at some point here that we're going to get inundated with a bunch of testimony from those commercial fishermen. We don't have a great many sign up today to testify, but we do have, I think, Mr. Nelson online. Lance, are you available online? We thought we did anyway, and apparently we don't, maybe we can have him available at our next hearing. At this point, not seeing any additional questions for Mr. Hilsinger and Ms. Juhas from the Department of Fish and Game, I'd like to thank you for being here today. And I guess Mr. Hilsinger for the comments.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate your indulgence. I did just want to add one point for Representative Kawasaki about the sonar at Pilot Station, since this took up a large part of my life this summer. We actually, besides the sonar, we have a pretty intensive test fishing program there. And in this case, we had some additional research going on. We actually had extra test fishermen out. And so we used that test fishing information to correlate with the sonar. And actually, had we gone only by the test fishery results, we would have been even more conservative than we were. The sonar actually gave us an indication that the run was better than what the test fishery showed. So I wanted to be sure that it was clear that we utilize a variety of different types of information, and sometimes they tell you a little bit different thing, and we just kind of have to decide what we think is right. But in this case, actually, even though there was some error in the sonar, it actually was probably more close to being right than the test fisheries were. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for coming forward and offering your testimony today. We do have, according to my list here, two people online to testify. However, I am going to make the decision at this point to hold off on taking public testimony, given that that we will have a new version of the bill before the committee, and I think it would make sense to take public testimony at that time. So with that, not seeing anything more to come before the committee, I'm going to adjourn the meeting at approximately 11:39 a.m. and wish everyone a good afternoon.